Judah are the prominent characters and whether or not they are going to try to take individual responsibility and say, I'm going to do things my way, or they're going to recognize that we need to do things God's way. Now, in the midst of this, however, we see a lot of the prophets of Israel, and we focus not so much on the nation in many of these chapters, but on individuals. And this is especially true in the next few chapters. The lens of the Bible, and I compared this to 2 Chronicles, the story that's next in those books, because they are parallel, the stories in those books are actually not going to show up in Kings and for like five chapters or so. So there's a few stories here that focus mostly on the individuals. And I think that's important for us to recognize that as we talk about God's hand of blessing on the nation and on the country as a whole, as we see the whole nation go one direction or another in Israel and in Judah, or as the king leads the nation one direction or another, and as the people follow, we also see God working in individual people's lives. And sometimes we can feel that way, though, too, can't we? When we watch the news and we see how God is working in America or in Pennsylvania, and we can sometimes lose the fact that God is interested in my life at the same time. And even if the rest of the nation goes down the tubes, my life can still be blessed. And of course, that still goes to say, though, that the rest of the nation is built up of individuals. And so the more people individually that God is blessing, the more he can bless us corporately. And in chapter 4, what we see is Elisha, our new prophet, he has just kind of taken the mantle, literally, from his predecessor Elijah, who had done many great things, who had stood up for truth. And in this chapter, we're going to see him dealing with individual people's lives. We're going to see him perform a bunch of miracles all right in a row. And in each of these situations, there's going to be something great that God does. And last time I read through this chapter, what I saw in this chapter was the miracles that God can do, the things that God can do, the things he's capable of doing. But this time reading through the chapter, I noticed something different. I didn't just see the miracles that God can do, but I saw kind of a prerequisite for God being able to do a miracle in their life. And so with that, I want to ask us a question in light of an example. Suppose you were driving down the road and your car breaks down. It breaks down on the side of the road. It's not going to work anymore. You turn the key and it makes a really weird sound that it's never made before, and it's not going anywhere. You call the shop. Hey, I need you to fix my car. If the shop is going to fix your car, what is the number one thing that the shop needs? Somebody tell me. The car. They need a wrench. They need a lift. They need technical equipment. They need a building. No, what they need is your car. That's what they need first. That's so obvious, that seems to go without saying. But because it's so obvious, we'll spend money. We'll pay the tow truck to come, and we'll dish out money long before anything has happened to our car to get our car to them, because we know they can't do a thing with our car unless they have our car. And the thing is, we're not going to call the shop. Hey, I need you to fix my car. Well, when can you get it down here? How's that now? When can you get it down here? Oh, no, I don't want to give you my car. I still need it today. But when can you fix it? That's not even a conversation we would have. And see, that's what we do to God, isn't it? God, I want you to do great things in my life. Well, I want to have your life. Well, I don't want to give you my life. I still want to do what I want to do, but I want you to do everything I want you to do in it, but I don't want you to have it. Yeah. And in this story, what we see is the people allowing God to work so that he can work, unlike most Christians who want to keep everything for themselves and just want God to jump in, fix all their problems, and then leave. And each one of these, we're going to see something that God can do, but we're going to see what we have to be involved with. If God's going to work in your life, then he has to have your life. And so you have to ask yourself this question. Are you holding on to your life and expecting God to fix it at the same time? And this is what we're going to see. We're going to see four miracles that God can work in our life as quickly as we can this morning. So some of these are very familiar stories, so they shouldn't take time, a lot of time to explain. But we're going to walk through this and give as much as we can here. So number one, God can fill. He can fill. And letter A, because we get empty. God can fill because we get empty. Look at the first verse of chapter 4. Now there cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets unto Elisha, saying, Thy servant, my husband, is dead. And thou knowest that thy servant did fear the Lord. And the creditor has come unto him, my two sons, to be bondmen. And Elisha said unto her, What shall I do for thee? Tell me, what hast thou in the house? And she said, Thine handmaid hath not anything in the house save a pot of oil. There's a lot of things in here, but you see kind of the pleading like they deserve help. You see, your servant, you know him. You taught him in Bible college because he was one of the sons of the prophets, one of the prophets that they were training. You know him. He feared God. So it's not like he's a foreigner to the things of God. He's involved in the things of God. He has died. And now it's just me and my sons. And I'm in debt now. Now the problem's getting worse and worse. My husband died. Now I'm in debt. I ran out of money. They're going to take my sons to be slaves so that I can pay off the debt. Very common practice back then. You couldn't pay off the debt. You worked off the debt. If you didn't have money, you didn't have a choice. You worked it off because that's the only way to pay it off. And so you basically became a slave automatically in order to work it off. And this is her situation. Last year, they had a happy family. Her husband was in ministry. Their sons were growing up. They had a house. They had food. And this year, husband's dead. Big debt. Can't pay it. My sons are going to be taken away. And she says, please do something. And Elisha says, what do you have? All I have is a pot of oil. Oil had a little value, not a lot of value, but it was something. It was it. And this is what he tells her to do. Verse 3. Then he said, Go, borrow the vessels abroad of all thy neighbors, even empty vessels, borrow not a few. When thou art come in, thou shalt shut the door upon thee, upon thy sons, and shalt pour out into all those vessels, and thou shalt set aside that which is full. God cared about her. She had nothing. She was empty, and God wanted to fill her. What I think is interesting, I noticed this for the first time this past week as I read it. It says, go into your house with your sons, with the vessels you've borrowed, and I want you to shut the door. A lot of times throughout the Bible, a miracle was in order to prove something else. It was in order to confirm the words that they were from God. Jesus would do a miracle in order to confirm his ministry that he was from God. And then the people would say, how could somebody do these great wonders if he were not from God? And that was the point. Often the miracle he would do was not an end in itself, but a tool for something greater. But here, he says, when I'm going to do something in your life, I want you to go into your house and I want you to shut the door on you and your sons. Because here he was telling her, actually, I want to do something in your life and it's just for you. That's the whole point of it. It's not to prove anything to your town or to your city or to your neighbors or to your country. Right now, actually, I'm concerned with just you. And so I want to just do something in your life. And he tells her to go to everybody's house and borrow empty pots and pans and bowls. Imagine that conversation. As many as you can have. He knocks on your neighbor's house. Hey, Martha, how are you? I'm doing good. I need something. What can I do for you? I need some pots and pans. Okay. How many you need? All of them. All the ones you got. Just anything you got. So they go in. They have every pot and pan and vessel and thing that can fit oil in. And then goes to her next neighbor. And she's walking down the street and her sons carrying all these piles of pots and pans. And she goes to her house. She closes the door and he says, and I will fill all of them. God will fill all of them. But look at this. Letter B. God will fill every pot we give him. See, in our life, we have empty holes in our life. We have empty things in our life. We get empty as people, and only God can fill us. We try to fill our heart with all kinds of things, don't we? We try to fill it with work and busyness. We try to fill it with friends and entertainment. We try to fill it with sports. We try to fill it with people. We try to fill it with relationships, and we will always be empty, and only God can fill us. And he's interested in doing that. He wants to fill our life. He wants us to not be empty. But he can only fill what we give him to fill. So this is what she does. She borrows a lot of vessels. Now, think about this. No matter how many pots and pans and bowls she borrowed, there was probably another pot and pan somewhere else that she could have borrowed one more, right? So the number of pots and pans she borrowed would be in direct correlation to how much she really believed it was going to help. See, that sometimes God tells us to do something, and how committed we are to what he tells us to do is going to be directly correlated to how much we really believe it's going to help us. And that's why a lot of Christians have varying degrees of commitment to what God says, because they have varying degrees of faith about how much that's actually going to be involved in their problem. I have nothing. My sons are going to slavery. You're telling me to borrow pots. How many pots she borrows is going to be how much she believes that those pots are going to help her sons not go into slavery. And anyway, she borrows a bunch and she brings them back. In verse 5, she went from him, shut the door upon her and upon her sons, who brought the vessels to her, and she poured out one pot of oil. It came to pass when the vessels were full, she said to her son, bring me, I love how they put this in here, bring me yet a vessel. Give me another one. And he said to her, there is not a vessel more, and the oil stayed. And she came and told the man of God. He said, go sell the oil, pay the debt, and live thou and thy children of the rest. Did you notice that? She had one bowl of oil, and every single pot that she had, that one bowl of oil would fill that pot. But it doesn't just say she filled all of them. It actually gives you the circumstance and the conversation that happened at the end. She got to the last pot. She filled it with oil. Then she asked, give me another one. And they didn't have another one. That was the last one that they had chosen to borrow. And at that moment, when there were no more pots to fill, there was no more oil to pour out. There is not one more, and the oil stayed. God filled every single pot she had, and no more and no less. Everything you give to God in your life to fill, he will fill. Yeah. If you give him one less area of your life, he will not fill that area. Mm-hmm. If you give him one more, there will be enough to fill it. God will fill every and only every pot that you give to him to fill. We want God, I am empty, fill me. And God says, bring me the pot and I will fill it. How devoted you are to that is going to depend on how much you believe that he can fill when you are empty. Number two, God can make something out of nothing. God can make something out of nothing. Letter A, because we are nothings. Because we are nothings. Elisha moves on and he meets a man and a woman. I'm going to read the next couple verses here in just a second, but I'm going to jump to what he does for them, and I'm going to back to what they did for him and what they did for God. He moves on, he meets a man and woman from Shunem, and they urge him to stay and eat and take care of them. He comes by now again, his travels, and he spends some time in the area. It's a common place for him to be, and she gets to a point where she says, hey, you know what we should do? We should build him a room on our house so that every time he comes, he has his own special place, and thus was the beginning of the term prophet's chamber, which some churches to this day have. They have a room in their church building for people who are coming by. Ours doesn't, but many churches do, and it kind of originated with this idea. And they had all of this, and they were doing this for them when they came by, Elisha and his servant, Gehazi, and he asked his servant, what can we do for them? Verse 11. So it fell on a day, he came thither, and he turned into the chamber and lay there. One of the times he stayed at the house. He said to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite. And when he had called her, she stood before him. He said unto him, say now unto her, behold, thou hast been careful for us with all this care. What is to be done for thee? What do you want? What can we do for you? Wouldest thou be spoken for to the king or to the captain of the host? And she answered, oh, I dwell among my own people. He said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, well, verily, she hath no child, but her husband is old. He said, call her. And when he had called her, she stood in the door, and he said, about this season, according to the time of life, thou shalt embrace a son. And she said, nay, my lord, thou man of God, do not lie unto thine handmaid. The reason why is both they were not going to be able to have kids. But that was probably a desire for her. What can we do for her? Well, she's never had a son before. Never. Well, we should ask God to give her a son. And she says, don't lie to me. Like, don't give me hope that I'm going to have a son. She had wanted this her whole life, and now the man of God is saying that it's going to happen. She said, you better be serious. And he says, I'm gonna give you a son. But she couldn't have one. God can do something out of people who aren't able to do it themselves. God can do something with those who are nothings. Those who do not have the capability can have God work in them to do something they wouldn't be able to do by themselves. This is the story of so many people throughout the Bible. One of the most prominent characters in the Bible, Moses, is probably known for standing up and speaking in front of large crowds before anybody else in the Bible has. And Moses stood in front of the people and said, and he gives these great eloquent speeches to them, and he has to stand in front of the king, who's the most powerful man in the whole world, to demand him to do something, and that takes a lot of courage. And when God told him he was going to use him to go to the people of Israel, he says, but I can't speak well. God, I can't do that because I don't have that in me. And God said, who made man's mouth? If I can make your mouth, I can help you speak. And so we say, well, no, God, I can't do that because I'm just me. I don't have the capability of doing that inside of me. And God says, if I made you, I can help you do anything I ask you to do. If I made you, I can do anything in your life. And the only way, however, that God can do something in our life is if we just acknowledge that we are nothings. At least Moses said, I can't do it without you. You have two sides of the coin. The Christian who says, God, I can't do what you're asking me to do, or God, you can't do that in my life because I'm nothing, and they don't trust God. Or the other side who's like, oh yeah, sure, I got that. And in the middle lies the Christian who recognizes that God can because I can't. We have to have both of those. We have to recognize we don't have the sufficiency in ourselves. We have to recognize that we are nothings. And then recognize that God can work. In John 15, Jesus says this, abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself except it abide in the vine, no more can ye except ye abide in me. God can do something with nothings, and we are nothings, but letter B, God can do something with nothing when we give God our everything. When we give God our everything. Do you think God just arbitrarily said, does she have a kid? Let's give her a kid. Why not? Why did he choose to give her one? Now, right now, our fellows are going to come by with the offering plate. If you could do us a favor and take the little attendance slip you got that says name on the top, just write your name in that and throw it in when they go by so we know who's in Sunday school this morning. We'd appreciate that. But look at verse 8. This is before that story started. Right before he says, what are we going to do for them? We've introduced what the woman did for God. Look at verse 8. It fell on a day Elisha passed to Shunem, where was a great woman. That doesn't mean she was big. That just means that she was important. Okay. There was a great woman, and she constrained him to eat bread. Sit down and eat bread. Well, we have some. No, you need to eat dinner. She's one of those moms, you know, you look like you haven't eaten in days. You need to be eating more. So she said, you come eat bread. And so it was that as often as he passed by, he turned thither to eat bread. She said to her husband, behold, now I perceive that this is a holy man of God which passes by us continually. Let us make a little chamber, I pray thee, on the wall, and let us set for him there a bed and a table and a stool and a candlestick. And it shall be when he cometh to us that he shall turn in thither. And then he says, what can we do for her? She wasn't promised any return. She wanted to give of herself to the work of God because that was important. She gave of her resources. She fed him. They had to build something. Then she gave up her personal space. Not only is she just doing something for when the prophet comes into town, that means whenever he happens to be walking by, he's going to stay at the house. Give of her time and her energy. She was willing to do this because the things of God were important enough to give of herself to it. And when she gave of herself to the things of God, then the things of God ended up doing something in her life. We want God to do something great with us, but we don't want to give God any part of our life. We want God to help our private life, but we haven't surrendered any of our private life to God. We want God to give us more time, but we want to use it for ourselves, and we haven't given any of our time to God. We wonder why God doesn't give us strength, and we don't use any of our energy for Him. We want God to provide, but we aren't honoring Him with our resources already. We want God to give us longer days to do more every day with ourselves, but we haven't spent any of our time for Him, much less is He going to do anything great with any of it. And this is where a lot of us come. God, do something great in my life, and you're not giving Him any of your life to do anything great with already. Look at verse 17. So He says, what can we do? We can give her a son. Verse 17, and the woman conceived and bare a son at the season that Elisha had said unto her, according to the time of life. There was no reason for her to have a child. It was impossible because she gave her life to God. God gave her, put something in her life she couldn't do for herself. A great illustration of this same point was actually originally going to be my fifth point, which is the last miracle in the chapter. But it was so similar to the point I was going to make here, I'm just going to say it as an illustration here. So look at verse 42. Flip to the end of the chapter real quick. Something similar happens here. At the end of this chapter, he's somewhere else. Elisha's talking to another guy, and he's trying to feed this group of people that came to him. There came a man from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of bread and full ears of corn in the husk thereof. He said, give unto the people that they may eat. And his servitor said, what, should I set this before 100 men? He said again, give the people that they may eat. For thus saith the Lord, they shall eat and shall leave thereof. And so he set it before them, and they did eat and left thereof according to the word of the Lord. He gives him bread and he says, feed all of these men. He says, I don't have enough to feed all of these people. He says, give it to them. Give what you have and it will be enough. Does that not remind you of another story in the Bible? Jesus is spending time with his disciples, and because he was moved with compassion on these people, he decided to sit down and teach them, and then the whole day passes, the whole afternoon passes, and he's got 5,000 men sitting there, and then he says, what should we give them to eat? And the disciples say, well, we don't have enough money to feed all of them. We don't have enough bread to feed all of them. And so Jesus says, but what do we have? And the boy gave what he had. But in a much more dramatic example, he gives only 5 loaves and 2 fish to feed thousands of people. But the problem is not whether or not what we have is ever enough, and whether or not the task is too big, because we're never enough and it's always too big for us. So no matter how dramatic the example is, if he has 20 loaves for 100 people, or if he has 5 loaves for 5,000 people, that's not the issue. The issue is whether or not we're willing to give him what we have for him to make something out of nothing with it. And we're all trying to keep the little bit we have for ourselves because we're complaining to God we're not enough, and God doesn't do anything with our life because we don't give him any part of our life. And then God doesn't do anything great with us. God can make something out of nothing when we give him everything. Number three, I'm doing so good. Say up with me. Number three, God can restore. God can restore. Same woman from the last story. Well, God allowed something odd to happen because he miraculously chose to give this woman a child. But now something's going to happen that's unexpected because the woman is going to lose her child. Letter A, when hope is lost. You can't do anything else. Verse 18, when the child was grown, the child that she just gave birth to, the child that came miraculously, the child that was a gift of God, the child that the woman said, please don't lie to me about a child. If you're going to tell me it, at least be truthful that it's actually going to happen. That child grows, and it fell on a day he went out to his father to the reapers. They went out to work. Dad and son, they're spending time with the guys out in the field. They're doing the daily stuff. It's a Tuesday morning, a regular day. In verse 19, he says to his father, my head. And he said to the lad, carry him to his mother. And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and he died. It doesn't say what happened. Did he get a brain tumor? Did he get some sort of disease? But he was fine in the morning and he was dead by lunch. And the woman is not happy. Now, by the way, pause. God's prerogative is to give and to take away. Okay? If God gives you something that you never deserve, he does not owe it to you for the rest of your life. So we have to recognize that. Job recognized that when he lost everything. He said, naked came out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord took away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So God would be just if he chose to not give to you today what he chose to give you yesterday. However, the question is fair. Why did you give me a child if you're just going to take it away? Because every mother in here is thinking the same thing. I would rather not had him at all than to be given to him and to watch him grow a couple years and to be stolen. That's what she was saying. Don't lie to me. And that's what she felt. She felt lied to now. I'm going to have a child. You didn't give me a son. You taunted me with a son. And she's going to come to Elisha and say, what did you do? Now, for sake of time, and because I want to make sure I have give Representative Perry as much time as possible here, from verse 20 to 32, basically this is what happens. This is the longest story in here. The woman rides out to meet Elisha, and she's very intent on seeing Elisha for obvious reasons. Elisha was the one that said miraculously she was going to have a child. Elisha's going to be the only one that can do anything about it. Now, think about it for a second. He's gone. He's not sick. He doesn't have a fever. He doesn't have bronchitis or pneumonia. He's not able to breathe. He died. But she still believes if God can make something out of nothing with her, then, you know, God can do something with her dead child. So she goes out to find Elisha. And some of the servants ride to meet her. Is everything okay? She says, yeah, everything's fine. But that's because she wants to talk to Elisha. She gets to Elisha and she says, no, everything's not fine. The son you gave me, didn't I tell you don't lie to me? The son you gave me, he died. And Elisha prays and asks God to do something here. But what he does is he gives his servant Gehazi his staff. He says, go to the room and lay the staff on the child. Gehazi is learning to be a prophet, to rely on the power of God. But what he does is he does exactly what Elisha tells him to do. He takes his stick. He goes into the room. He looks at the child by himself. The woman's still with Elisha, and he just lays the stick on the child. Imagine if you were told to do that. Put the stick, the staff, on the child. And then he's poking him. Nothing happens. He didn't expect anything to happen. A stick has never healed a dead person before, so I don't know what you wanted me to do. He comes back. It didn't work. And so Elisha says, fine, I'll go. And so Elisha goes with the son. Now, by the way, there was nothing powerful in the stick, okay? The stick on the kid wasn't actually what was going to heal him because the staff wasn't magical, okay? He was supposed to rely on the power of God. It wasn't the method. It wasn't the step-by-step process. He was supposed to go through the spell that heals dead people. That wasn't what was going on, and it didn't work because that's not what it was. By the way, when you want God to do something in your life, it's not about the religious steps that you're supposed to go through. Well, pastor does this and this and this, so if I do X, Y, and Z, then God's going to do that in my life. It's not about the steps and the things or the ritual. It's about relying on the power of God. And Gehazi didn't know how to rely on God's power. He just thought that if I touch him with the stick, it'll all be okay. Elisha recognized that God was going to be able to do something if he allows him to. Now, the woman is very upset. Her son is dead. And she doesn't go, however, into the room and pace back and forth and watch what he does and sees whether or not he's doing enough. No, she allows Elisha to go into the room by himself and shut the door. Look at verse 33. He went in, therefore, and shut the door upon them twain and prayed unto the Lord. And that's after verse 32, when he was coming to the house, Elisha was, and the child was dead and laid upon his bed. What do we need to do? Let her be. When all hope is lost and we want God to restore, we have to give God the time and the space to work. Give God the time and the space to work. Elisha was the one who could, with God's power, Elisha was going to be able to do something about it. And she knew, I can't. Hope is lost. This is not going to be restored. But she allowed him to do his thing and didn't have to get involved. A lot of us want to allow God to fix some problems in our life, restore some things in our life, but then we don't actually give him any time to do it because we're too busy trying to do it ourselves. And I'm terrible with this. I get my fingers into everything. I can't let anybody else do anything. I like to just do it myself, even if I'm not good at it. This is what we do to children when they're trying to play like a puzzle or something. You know, you have the two-year-old and they got the puzzle and there's like 10 giant wooden pieces and they're all extremely different shapes and they're trying to fit it into every other one that doesn't make sense. And you're sitting there just put it in this one, you know? You just want to do it for them. Good job, you finally did the puzzle. And what we do is we treat God like a child. We say, God, can you do this in my life? And he just doesn't do it in time. Just let me do it instead. We want God to fix our marriage, but we want God to restore it in our life. But we're too busy trying to fix our spouse. We're going to try to do it ourselves. We want God to fix our life, but we're not letting him. We're too busy trying to do it on our own. We're too busy getting involved. We're so impatient. We don't give God the time and the space to work, then he won't. Psalm 27 says, wait on the Lord and be of good courage, and he shall strengthen thine heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. If you want God to do something, let him do something. If you're going to do something, then you're not going to let him have the opportunity to do so. So look at verse 34. He went up, lay upon the child, and put his mouth upon his mouth, and his eyes upon his eyes, and his hands upon his hands, and he stretched himself upon the child. And the flesh of the child waxed warm. He returned and walked in the house to and fro, and went up and stretched himself upon him. And the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. I have no spiritual application to any of that, so I'm sorry. Verse 36, he called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite, and he called her. And when she was come in unto him, he said, take up thy son. And she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground and took up her son and went out. God purposefully took the child's life so that he could show the woman that he could do even greater miracles than the ones he had done before. The child was fine also by the end of the day. He woke up perfectly healthy. He also went to sleep perfectly healthy. In the middle there was where they had to rely on God for it. Now, by the way, just a short side note as we're going through this, as far as I can tell, this is the first resurrection in history in the Bible. No time before this had a person died and come back to life. We're like, oh yeah, well, resurrection. I mean, God's done that before. You know, when we're reading the Bible, we expect the person to live at the end. We wouldn't, but even Elisha didn't have any precedent to look back on. God had never risen anybody after they had died. So everyone in the room felt like there was no reason for it to come back to life. But if God can, God can do anything. He can give life when somebody has passed away, and he does. You know what, when you're asking God to restore something in your life, you don't need a precedence in order to say, God, you can because you have. That's true, but God isn't able simply because he has before. If no one in your family has ever been able to stay married to the same person that they got married to the first time, that doesn't mean God can't restore your marriage just because nobody before you has worked for. If everybody in your life seems to be a failure and has gotten into something and just has thrown away their life, that doesn't mean that your life can't be different. God doesn't need a precedence to do something great and to restore. God can restore if we just allow him to work. And I'll give you the last one and we'll be done. Number 4, God can fix. God can fix, letter A, when we have ruined. When we have ruined. What if you're the one at fault? This woman asked God to restore something in her life, but it was not her doing. It wasn't the dad's doing. It wasn't anybody's fault. Just something bad happened. Something happened and they wanted God to help them with it. But they knew it wasn't because they did it. Something got broken. The thing is, this time in this story, the problem is because somebody did something that just was not smart. Look at this. In today's society, we balk at this, but I guess back then it was more normal. But verse 38, last story. Elisha came again to Gilgal, and there was a dearth in the land. So there really wasn't a lot of food. He didn't just go down to the field and pick corn. There was a lot less to find, so he had to scrounge up some other stuff. There was a dearth in the land, and the sons of the prophets were sitting before him. He said to his servant, set on the great pot and seed pottage for the sons of the prophets. Make a big pot of soup. And one went out into the field to gather herbs, and he found a wild vine. and gather thereof wild gourds, his lap full, and came and shred them into the pot of pottage, for they knew them not. Had no idea what they found, but it looked good. It looked kind of like a vegetable, so let's throw it in the soup, because we need more food. Verse 40, they poured out for the men to eat, and it came to pass as they were eating of the pottage, they cried out and said, O thou man of God, there is death in the pot, and they could not eat thereof. As they tasted it, they realized, this is not edible, but they had already eaten it. And so they asked him what to do. You know, we all can make mistakes really quickly. Just all of a sudden, it just happens, you know. Things just happen and we don't even realize it. We weren't thinking, we do something that's really dumb. And when you're cooking, you can put in the wrong ingredient. 3 tablespoons is a lot different than 3 teaspoons when it comes to certain ingredients. And all of a sudden, it's just done. Throw away the whole thing. Mistakes can happen instantly. Problems, sin can happen without us just thinking it. We just ruin something. That day was fine, and then we just ruined the rest of our life because of something dumb that we did. And this is what he tells them to do. Verse 41. He says, bring meal, and he cast it into the pot, and he said, pour out for the people that they may eat, and there was no harm in the pot. So when God can fix how, letter B, when we give him the option to put anything in our life that he wants. I have ruined this pot. And he says, give it to me, and he put something into it, and then it was restored. Like, no, it's ruined. You can't just put something into it. It's gone. It's no. Let me put something into it, and then it'll fix it. We ask God to fix our life, and then God says, all right, bring me your life. I'm gonna put a bunch of things into it that you need. This is going to fix your life. Oh, no, that's not going to fix my life. I need you to just take out the problem. He says, no, I need to put some things into it. There's a lot of things that God's trying to put into your life. He's trying to put in righteousness and wisdom and character, and he's trying to put in the desire to seek the Lord, and that fixes a lot of our problems. In Romans 8, it tells us that all things work together for good to those who love God. God works things together for good when we have some things in our life. And when we have a problem, and maybe we caused it, God asks for your life and says, I want to put some things into it so that I can help you. We want God to do great things. We want God to help us. We want God to fix us. We want God to restore us, but we don't allow him the option to do it. We don't give him the space. We don't give him our lives. We don't give him our resources. We don't give him our time. And then we wonder why he's not doing it what we want him to. If you want God to work, God can work if you allow him to, and if you give him the time and the effort and the space and the parts of your life to work in. God can if you'll give it to him. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for our opportunity this morning. And Lord, all the stories throughout the Bible, and we'll see many more of the things that you can do. Help us to recognize, however, it's our responsibility to not try to do it ourselves, to do what you ask us to do, to put anything in our life you want to obey any command you give to us, and trust that those are the things that you want from us so you can do what we cannot. And so, Lord, I pray that that would be our desire for everyone in here. I pray it would be with these many prayer requests we're about to hear in just a moment, that you would bless the morning service that we'll have here in just a few minutes, that you would speak to hearts. We pray this in your name. Amen. Thank you, Brother McConkie. We're going to mention a couple quick prayer requests. I don't see a crowd trying to burst into the doors quite yet, so I'll read these, and then we will be dismissed to our morning service. The McConkies are praying for Glenn Layson Jr., who has health issues. We will make sure that that's on the prayer list. Amy Lauber is praying for Larry and Tyler and Jay, some of the folks she's praying for. Ms. Sarah Smith is praying for her son's salvation, daughter's repentance, and the sale of her house in grad school. Ed Camberger is praying for Dawn Camberger and for emotional and spiritual healing, and for himself to grow and to serve and to heal with his heart and marriage. And Jim and Sharon French are praying for their grandson, JJ, who is leaving for the Army tomorrow. And so pray for them, pray for our military, and their safety. Well, let's take these to the Lord in prayer, and then we'll be dismissed to our morning service. Father, thank you for answers to prayer.